My name is Shane Brockoff, and I work with Dr. Nick Christians there at Iowa State University. And for the past year and a half or so, I've been playing around with this biochar stuff. So what is biochar? Really, biochar is just another name for a charcoal material. If you burn an organic material, you get a high carbon content char or charcoal. And that's what biochar is, but it's really not that simple. Biochar actually refers to a co-product of fast pyrolysis, which is a biofuel production process that a lot of engineers and agronomists are working on right now. The biochar that I used was a fast pyrolysis switchgrass feedstock biochar. Biochars come in all ranges and sizes, depending on the production process, the feedstock you use, and et cetera. So I got my biochar from the Center for Sustainable and Environmental Technologies at Iowa State University. Dr. Robert Brown was nice enough to give me some of his biochar. Some previous biochar research shows that this is in normal soils. Improves cation retention, or CEC, increases crop yields, and is also very stable in the soil, which is important for two reasons. The first reason is for turf grasses. Most of our sand-based root zones, we use peat moss to amend when we build our sand-based greens. Peat moss breaks down fairly rapidly or relatively rapidly over time, and kind of reduces some of the physical properties of the sand-based soil, where it wasn't as good as when it started. The second reason is, this is a slide taken from Dr. David Laird, who works in the National Soil Tilth Laboratory at Iowa State University. And it's kind of a busy slide. I don't want you guys to get caught up in all the numbers and everything, but the process is what's important. So you start off with a farm or soil, and you produce some sort of biomass. And this is called the biochar vision, is what a lot of agronomists talk about. And what they're talking about is they start with the biomass and they send it to these local pyrolyzers for the pyrolysis process. So the pyrolyzers, usually a fast pyrolysis process where the feedstock is fed into the pyrolyzer and it burns within about 500 degrees Celsius in about a second or two. So it's really fast process, and there's three co-products produced. First one is bio oil, which is why they're doing the process in the first place. They want this oil they can refine, send to consumers, which you can see at the bottom. And the second co-product is a syngas. And they use this gas, they feed it back into these pyrolyzers, and it runs the process, kind of helps feed the efficiency of the system. And the third product is this biochar, or charcoal material. And the another reason why its stability is important is that they think this is a net negative carbon cycle, meaning that it takes carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's the sequestration of this system might be important for the global carbon cycles, some of the discussion going on with global warming. So that Glazer paper I referenced earlier estimated the half-life of this biochar, some of these biochars, is about 1,000 years. I'd be a little skeptical that it is a fairly long period of time, but temperature, climate, and the type of feedstock that went into the system kind of changes its half-life. I'm assuming that's an assumption, but so I think it's fairly long, but 1,000 years might be skeptical. So the stability of carbon is important, and this is the biochar vision. But what's going to make this relative to us is we need to find research that proves this to be practical for turf grass industry. So that's kind of what I'm working on. There's a big flurry of research going on right now with biochar and agronomy, and we're just starting to do this in turf grass. So my three objectives, basically to quantify the effects biochar has on sand-based root zones as far as soil water retention, hydraulic conductivity or infiltration rates, and the rooting depth of T1 creeping bentgrass, Agrostis stolonifera. So my six treatments, they're consistent for all three of those objectives in the studies. I made six volume-to-volume mixes of biochar and sand, and you can see them ranging from 0% biochar was my control, up to 25% biochar and 75% sand, with 5% increment increases. And that was on a volume-to-volume basis. So my first study was my soil water retention study. I had four replications in a completely random design. Due to the restrictions of my equipment, I had to break it up into two parts just because of the high pressures of the last four matrix potentials. On the bottom there, I used pressure plate chambers. And then for my first six, I used pressure chamber table. It really doesn't have a name, but I use it in the soil physics department there at Iowa State. Dr. Robert Horton helped me out a lot with that. And here is a picture of that soil water retention chamber table. This was in the physics lab. You can see that there are 24 cores, so my six treatments were completely random over that 24 cores. Each core is individual, so it has its own individual chamber, but the pressure among them, all those tubes are connected, so the pressure is the exact same in that whole system. Here's a kind of a close-up. You can see that it's gasket sealed with grease around it, so it's completely sealed off, and then there's a filter paper on the bottom. And going back to this picture, you can see that I changed the pressure, and I collected the volume of water in those graduated cylinders at the bottom of each pressure, and I could back calculate the volumetric water content, my soil water retention curves. This picture is just showing that I used a water manometer, so I wasn't relying on a pressure gauge to tell me what pressure I was at. I was at the actual differential based on the density of water, so I used a water manometer. And then at the higher ones, up to a third bar, or up to 100 centimeters, I believe I used the mercury manometer. So, and this is just your standard pressure plate chamber, up to 15 bars is what I used that for down in our lab. So here are my soil water retention curves. It's kind of a busy slide. The y-axis is my volumetric water content, or my theta V, and then the x-axis is my matrix absolute value of matrix potential, and that you can see my 10 matrix potentials that I tested. And then my colors for my bars, the far right, the white ones, is my 25% biochar, and going down to the red is my 0% biochar, 100% sand. You can see that the biochar had a definite significant effect at all pressures on water retention. So that's basically the general trend, is that you decrease biochar, you decrease water retention, and vice versa. There is a couple blurbs here at the beginning. My 0% biochar treatment actually showed more water retention. I'm not sure if that's a result of my error in estimating or in doing the actual measurement, or if that's something I haven't figured out how to explain yet, but that was something that was a little bit different from starting at 49.049 bars and on. It was a consistent range. Instead of analyzing every single pressure here, what I did was I decided to analyze plant available water. So I did it for two different estimates of field capacity. The first one was here at 0.025, or about 25 centimeters of tension, and this one at 50 centimeters of tension, or 0.049 bars, and then I subtracted from 15 bars, so the volumetric water content between those two, for those two estimates of field capacity, because we talked to a soil physicist and who does a lot of this, and they thought about 40 centimeters or 0.049 bars would be about right for field capacity. Depends on the interface of where your choker layer is, the sand and the gravel in your sand-based root zone. So here's my means analysis. On the left are my percent biochar, so my six treatments. And you can see that this is at the field capacity mean, so those two retention curves at those two pressure matrix potentials. This is the volumetric water content analysis. And you can see that increasing biochar significantly had an increase in the amount of water retained. These are based off Fisher's protected LSDs at a probability level 0.05. So here's a kind of a graphic of my plant available water. Again, this is the blue ones are at the 25 centimeters or 0.025 bar, and the red is at 0.049 bar. And my six treatments are on the bottom, and that's my percent plant available water on the y-axis. Essentially what this graph shows is that increasing biochar increases plant available water based on matrix potential measurements. And there's whether you go with 0.049 bar or 0.025 bar, it's just a change in how much water is pushed out of that core. So, but the general trend is the same for both measurements of, or estimates of field capacity. All right, so on to my saturated hydraulic conductivity measurements. I basically just resaturated those cores that I used in the pressure chamber table. So I had the exact same core units, and I used a Marriott bottle method. So you can see the Marriott bottle at the top of the picture. This is kind of a crude picture, but I just maintained a constant head, measured the head height on that core of water. So I completely saturated them, maintained a constant head of water, and then I measured the volume outflow over a given time over a cross-sectional area of my core there, so I could get my KSAT numbers. And that's what you see on the left are my KSAT values, cubic centimeters of water, milliliters of water, per my cross-sectional area of my core per second. And you can definitely see that the biochar had a really significant effect on the saturated hydraulic conductivity, and it decreased pretty consistently. One thing I did notice that was interesting with the data is that there's kind of a plateau right here up to about 10% biochar. I haven't looked into it a whole lot, but the means analysis, you can show that those two are not significantly different. Maybe we can make some recommendations based off that when we write up the paper, but I converted those KSAT numbers in those weird units down to inches per hour, and the USGA minimum for a fresh green right after it's built is 6.1 inches per hour, or 6.0 inches per hour, and at 20% biochar, I was having 6.1 inches per hour, but that's without grass growing on it and it maturing over time, so that might actually decrease a little bit with grass, but research would have to be done to prove that. But you can see 25% biochar without any grass growing on it was already down to 2.6 inches per hour, so definite significant effect on KSAT. Okay, on to my third study, which is root growth, my root growth study. I used T1 creeping bentgrass, and I seeded at a rate of 0.006 kilograms per square meter. It was in a controlled environment greenhouse. The environment data stayed pretty consistent throughout the whole study. I didn't use any additional lighting or overhead high-pressure sodium lights or anything like that. I just used the natural light. The relative humidity ranged from about 20 to 60%, with the average being right around 40. It spiked after I watered it. For fertility, I watered at seeding with Hoagland solution, and I did it based on the nitrogen amount in the Hoagland solution, about 0.005 kilograms of nitrogen per square meter, and then I also did it at 2 months. And these studies lasted 110 days, so 110 days after seeding, I took data on them. And then for watering, I watered daily with a spray bottle, about 2 milliliters a day right after seeding, and then I did that until it germinated. About 2 weeks after germinating, I started slowing it down, and eventually I got down to 15 milliliters of water once per week, so trying to get root growth to go deep. So here, it was a completely random design. This is in the greenhouse with all six of those same treatments of biochar sand mix. At the base of those tubes, there is a pea gravel layer, or pea gravel at the bottom, and then about a 12-inch root zone of the sand char mixes that I made, and then I planted creeping bentgrass T1 at the top. So completely random in a greenhouse. After 110 days, I sliced them open with a blade, and you can see the roots are pretty deep in there. And then I washed them over that mesh screen they're sitting on. So I took the plastic off and I just shower washed them on that mesh screen. And this is kind of the results I got. So treatments one is on the left, all the way up to treatment six. So again, you can see a really significant reduction in root growth, root depth. And treatment three was really long. This is just one of my reps. I actually repeated this study twice, and there was no significant interaction with the experiment, so I was able to combine the data. So in my means analysis coming up here, there's actually 8 samples per treatment. So there's one picture, and this was fairly consistent for all replications of this treatment, so all 8 replications. And you can see again that after about 10% biochar, it was significantly reduced rooting depth. So here's analysis of these root length means. You can see that after 10% biochar has really started to shut down rooting depth. And you can see it in Fisher's LSD, that those after 10% were significantly reduced compared to the ones below 10% biochar and at 10% biochar. So my conclusions, biochar significantly increases water retention and plant available water based off matrix potential only. And then biochar significantly decreases KSAT or saturated hydraulic conductivity and also the rooting depth of T1 creeping bentgrass above 10% volume-to-volume mix of biochar. I want to give a special thanks to, I think I mentioned her name, Katie Brewer is a graduate student for Robert Brown and CSET there at Iowa State. She lent me the biochar, helped me out a lot. And also Dedrick Davis and Dr. Robert Horton in the Soil Physics Department. Wouldn't have been able to do it without those two guys, so I really appreciate their help and appreciate you guys' attention. I'd like to answer any questions if you have any. Oh, biochar. Yeah.
So explain to me how biochar might differ from activated charcoal and what you might suspect in terms of this material either trapping things in the root zone, potential contaminants, or also maybe interfering with herbicides or other pesticides.
That's a great question, and really the research is pretty active right now with biochar. As far as activated charcoal goes, I haven't read a whole lot about it, but it's fairly similar stuff. This biochar, they heat it at such a high temperature, And I'm not sure how they treat activated charcoal, how do they make it, but it has a lot of aromatic rings in it, and that gives it a lot of its chemical properties as far as how it reacts in the soil with different nutrients. Mark Slavens is a turf graduate student at Cornell, and he has a poster tonight about some nutrient retention properties of this biochar and sand mix, so we're kind of doing really parallel research on biochar. So you might be able to answer that question a little better than I can. As far as activated charcoal compares, I don't know. I can't answer that question. Yeah.
Is the biochar amenable to like particle size analysis, or can you get different gradations? How does that affect physical properties?
It is, and that's what Katie Brewer is doing in the CSET lab. She's doing a lot of the physical and chemical analysis of this biochar. And the biochar I have is really powdery. Like, if you breathe on it too hard, it blows away. But if you burn it at a lower temperature, it changes its structure, and it's a lot bigger particles. I'm sure you could get like a surface area analysis on it. Is that your question? Surface area analysis of the biochar, but it'd probably lend itself to it. I know she's doing a lot of work with that. So,
another question in the back, I believe.
Okay.
Do you notice any disease differences on your check without biochar?
The question is, did we notice any disease differences without biochar? The answer is no. In this control environment greenhouse, and I was only watering once a week, so it stayed fairly dry. So Pythium development really wasn't a problem in that greenhouse, and the temperature never really got into the Pythium range. So no, I didn't see any differences based on disease tolerance or anything like that. So that's a good question, though. So that kind of lends itself to that we need to do a lot more field research with this biochar mixed with sand to see how it really acts in the field based on the real weather conditions, which is constant with all research. You need to put it in the field before you can really make recommendations.
What is the density of it?
The density of this stuff is really low. Actually, I did do the bulk density measurements. I don't know what the actual biochar is, but biochar mixed with sand, starting off with just pure sand, was like 1.9 grams per cubic centimeter. And with the 25% biochar, it was down to like 1.4 grams per cubic centimeter. So it lowered the density of the sand and char mix. I didn't do the density of the actual biochar itself. So,
just by observation, does it change? If you let it get dry in a sand mixture, does it cake up or anything like that? Just by maybe something else you noticed?
Visually, no. But it is somewhat water repellent, and it might be due to the fact that it's such a small particle and it fills in water voids and shuts down KSAT. But it kind of forms like a hydrophobic layer on the top, so that's something I visually noticed. Caking? No, I don't think it like changes the clod structure or anything like that. So, but this is in pretty coarse structured sand. So,
any other questions? Okay, let's give him a hand for his presentation.